You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. To the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 53 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. IBEW Local 53 represents construction linemen, electric, gas, and water utility workers, broadcast engineers at TV stations, line clearance workers, linemen for rural electric cooperatives, employees at rural electric generating stations, and anyone else who's interested. And Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in Western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we welcome back John Boyd, a leading attorney for labor. We'll talk about what's at stake for working people in this election year. And then Casey Tennant's Tara Ragavir is making national news, championing the rights of renters, and you can learn how to avoid an eviction during the pandemic from our interview. In the news, strike in St. Joseph at Silgen Containers enters its third month with a call for solidarity. And if the U.S. hadn't gone down the inequality path 45 years ago, how much would you be making today? Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. She asks, can an employer use the pandemic as an excuse to cut your wages? Now for the news. The news from our side, September 17th, 2020. Cammie Jones is a leader of the workers at Silgen Containers in St. Joseph, Missouri. She posted this message on Facebook, quote, as we enter into our ninth week of strike, this is what we are facing with the complete corporate greed from Silgen Containers. Our membership has asked literally for nothing but to keep our working conditions the same. Corporate has proposed a 15-page wish list that changes our set schedule to a rotating one, takes over management of our 401k investments, removes seniority advantage to our overtime, forces our members on 12-hour days to work up to 21 days in a row, and our members on 8-hour shifts can be worked 365 days a year. Forced work on all holidays. The list goes on and on. All of this with minimal contribution to insurance and minimal raise that puts our members going back in the door for 15 cents less an hour at the start of this contract. We're asking for help. On Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m., we would like as much support as we can get at Rest Square Park, which is at 2222 Voorhees Street in St. Joseph, Missouri, to show solidarity. It's a small park, but it's directly across the street from our plant manager's home. How convenient. Please let me know if you're able to attend, and she is on Facebook. Thank you. The workers are members of Sheet Metal Workers Local 2. Nicholas Livick, a member of the UAW, is organizing a Kansas City Flying Squadron of workers to do strike solidarity. Stay tuned.
Nick Hanaher of Pitchford Economics and David Rolfe, a former SEIU local president and author of The Fight for 15 in Time magazine, say the stories about the causes and impacts of COVID-19 ignore what they call the elephant in the room. That is extreme income inequality. How big is this elephant, they ask? A staggering $50 trillion. That's how much the upward redistribution of income has cost American workers over the past several decades. They cite a groundbreaking working paper from Rand Corporation, which finds that if the more equitable income distribution we had in the 30 years after World War II, that's 1945 to 1974, been maintained, Americans in the bottom 90% of income earners would have had incomes $2.5 trillion higher in the year 2018 alone. That amount would have doubled median income and been enough to pay for every single working American in the bottom 90% an additional $1,144 a month, every month, every single year. The authors found that the pace and increase of inequality lately is $2.5 trillion a year and reached $50 trillion early this year. That means that instead of going into the pockets of the 90% of us, the $50 trillion went into the bank accounts and flamboyant lifestyles of only 10% of us. If this hadn't happened, we would today have a much larger and more prosperous economy, and we would have enabled a vast majority of Americans to enter this pandemic far more healthy, resilient, and financially secure. If American prosperity had continued to be broadly shared, the authors calculate that a worker making, say, $36,000 a year would make $64,000 adjusted for inflation. That's how much we've lost because of the rise in inequality in the last 45 years. If you take out the fact that so many low-wage workers are actually working more hours and more jobs than in 1975, the loss in wages due to rising inequality is substantially higher, about $42,000 a year lost.
This comes from Heartland Labor Forum volunteer Cortland Smith. Last Thursday, the world, and especially the Kansas City, was abuzz. The beginning of the NFL season started with our defending champions, Kansas City Chiefs, versus Houston's Texans. The game was exactly what we'd hoped for, a resounding 34-20 victory. The game was observed by 17,000 raucous fans who braved the COVID-19 concerns to cheer on their Chiefs. It was a shining moment for the team and for the city. Unfortunately, some of the dedicated fans at the game shed a negative light on the city. The players from both teams lined up at the 50-yard line to observe a moment of silence for unity and social justice. Instead of a moment of silence, the world was able to see Kansas City at its worst. Many of the fans booed during this time, and it was caught on national television. DeMaurice Smith, head of the NFL Players Association, said that he was proud of the players' show of unity despite the fan reaction. Patrick Mahomes, Super Bowl champion, face of the league and the Chiefs, starting quarterback, has been on the forefront of the NFL message for social justice. So it begs the question, do the Chiefs fans support their quarterback and team when the ball is in the air? Or do they support their hope for positive change in the world? The news tonight was read by Judy Ensel, Tom Gerpkin, and I'm Michael Savoy.
and money. Dad, get me out of this.
I'm Tom Gebkin. I'm with CWA 6360 here in Kansas City, and I'll be hosting this segment. With the anti-union climate currently in Missouri and Kansas, unions often need to seek the advice of legal counsel. Kansas City is home to one of the best labor attorneys in Missouri and Kansas, if not the country. For many unions, they turn to attorney John Boyd. Mr. Boyd's list is long. He is the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award of the Workers' Injury Law and Advocacy Group, local counsel to the Missouri AFL-CIO, the National Football League Players Association panel of workers' compensation attorneys, receiving the Attorney of the Year Award in 2018. He also serves as attorney for the Professional Hockey Players Association, serves as the legal counsel to many local unions, and John gives his time to many organizations. Kids Chance of Missouri, Jobs with Justice, Boy Scouts of America, the Jackson County Combat Commission, as well as many other groups. John, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thank you for that introduction and for the welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're one of the best lawyers here in town. Would you tell our audience how you got your start and how you became interested in labor law?
Long before I was even in high school, I attended my first labor union meeting when my dad, drew the short straw and had to do something with me when he had a union meeting. So he took me to it, and I must have been 7 or 8, and I remember he bought a 6-pack of bottles of double cola, and I consumed all 6 of those 16-ounce bottles of double cola during the union meeting. And I remember smoke and Budweiser's and Schlitz beer at the time, and it was fascinating even for a little kid at that point. Well, my dad was taught me the value of solidarity early on. We watched that in our family and bought American and did all those things that so many of your listeners did. I went to law school, obviously, after first graduating from college, and it was the ability to go to college and pay for it that came from the strong union job that my dad had at the time. So without his ability and earnings capacity, and my mother worked full-time owning a beauty shop, without that and what they taught me, I would not have had the ethic to pursue that area of study of helping people who need help against corporations and greedy insurance companies and so forth. So that was part of the stage that was set, and then the other part was I had an opportunity after I left the bench. I was a judge for a period of time, and I joined a lawyer and became his partner, and he represented the Machinist Union, and I got to know several of the leaders in that union, and then the Missouri AFL needed a counsel from the side of the state, and it blossomed. And frankly, I enjoy the company of the men and women of labor, both socially as well as professionally, and feel very comfortable representing their interests because I know they're right.
What union
That's
was your dad
answer.
In? John, what union was your dad in?
He was in the IBEW.
Did he have a long career there?
And I was a, and actually, Tom, if I stop practicing law, I can go back on my withdrawal card because I was a member of, at that time, it was a retail clerks union when I was working for a grocery store.
Wow.
Of course, that's now the UFCW, but I have that withdrawal card somewhere.
Well, in 2018, the Missouri legislature passed House Bill 1413, this placed a lot of restrictions on government employees who are union members. The governor signed the bill, and a lawsuit was filed to overturn this law. Would you tell us your role in that lawsuit and discuss the lawsuit?
Sure. The law, when we looked at it, we thought it was unconstitutional for a lot of reasons. But when you think about your right to speak, your right to peacefully assemble, your right to point out to the public that, hey, box handlers for Amazon get paid more per hour than people who man the phones for emergency calls, the 911 operators, we're getting paid less, and they save lives. And so that information needed to be spread to the public as the contract for a particular group of 911 operators was being negotiated. And so the bill that you mentioned that became law outlawed that. Peaceful, lawful assemblies for the purpose of non-disruptive picketing. So we studied that and filed a lawsuit. We had the trial in Jackson County. In the circuit court, the judge agreed with us and declared that part unconstitutional. It was appealed, and ultimately the Missouri Supreme Court ruled in our client's favor that it is indeed unconstitutional. There's other litigation still pending before the Missouri Supreme Court as to the balance of a really onerous law that it's clear the effort is to take away the right of your listeners to join public sector labor unions and to make it so difficult for unions to be representing public sector employees that it's unaffordable and unattainable with all of the peculiar requirements well beyond those that private sector labor union members face. So in short, the idea was to kill public sector labor unions in Missouri through this bad legislation that was fought successfully in the courts.
When the other side was promoting this through the courts, what would they say? So it's okay that we stop, that people can't protest, or how would they justify the law?
That the principal argument was that, and this was our Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, and before him, his Republican predecessor, they fought it on the basis that the state could lawfully regulate public sector employees' conduct, even when it was on their private time, when they weren't on the clock. And so it was a violation, we believed, of the right of free speech. Some of your listeners may remember there was a U.S. Supreme Court case decided where a freeloader wanted to have the benefits of a union but didn't want to pay for it, and because it was a public sector case that went up to the Supremes and U.S. Supremes, and that case was decided that the fair share that he had to pay infringed upon his freedom of speech. So we used that case and said, you can put your foot on the throat of Missouri citizens who happen to belong to a union, and that is an effort to thwart their ability to speak. It's a freedom of speech issue, and the Attorney General in the state of Missouri ultimately had no good answer for that.
With the Republican supermajority being in place for quite a number of years now, every legislative session brings with it another tack on labor and working families. And we don't want to repeat right to work fighting it. We don't want to have more attacks on prevailing wage and more attacks on state workers. What should voters look for this election in a candidate when deciding who to vote for?
Well, we can spend the next hour and a half on that one. The thing that I would suggest first and foremost is to widen your source of information about the candidates. Don't listen to one particular group for all your information because of the advertising and the biases that we see, whether it's Fox, its counterparts on the other side. I think our unions, our leadership, understand which politicians are supportive of the membership's earning capacity, their ability to provide for their family. I think our union leadership also has the ability to educate and answer questions for our members that aren't in the forefront of discussion. For example, how many people have heard that Democrats want to defund the police? That's on the news nowabouts, but it's not necessarily so at all. Governor Parson defunded the police and other emergency first responders by unilaterally cutting $2.66 million from the Department of Public Safety's budget for the current fiscal year. Two-thirds of that amount was for the Highway Patrol. A year ago, when violent crime increased across Missouri, House Democrats urged the governor to call a special legislative session to take action. He refused. Of course, now he just had a special session on that, but they did not pass anything of consequence that he wanted in this special session. So it's not so much the yelling and the shirts and the flags and all of that, but it's the substance. And that's where our unions have done the digging and vetted the candidates. And our leadership, I think, can really help immensely. That said, you can go online to the Missouri House of Representatives website and look at the bills that were introduced. And in the 2020 session alone, there are bills that were introduced by all Republican representatives that would bar employees from becoming or remaining or refusing to become a member of a labor organization or pay dues. In other words, you can't force somebody to join a labor union, so it's right to work. Current public bodies can license contractors, but if you're a plumber or an electrician, just for two examples, you want in your public buildings or in your home, for that matter, a licensed contractor and a licensed journeyman help to and taking care of whatever your problems are, building whatever you're building. But what they want to do is make it so that if a contractor has a license, then the contractor can go and hire anybody to work on that project, literally off the street, who has no license and no training. So it's an effort to undermine union contractors and union members and take away jobs and take away your ability to provide for your family. There are instances we counted up, and by the way, Robbie Sauls is a state representative, a former assistant prosecuting attorney in Jackson County, and he's a member of our law firm. He just finished a special session in Jeff City. There was little done other than a lot of wasted effort, you could say. But he's a member of the Democratic Party. He's running for re-election. And he pulls his hair out at some of this harebrained stuff that continues to be pushed under the concept of, well, we've got these union bosses that are doing all these terrible things. Well, that's not so at all. So thankfully we have individuals like him that are in our legislature and so many others in the area that watch out for all of our members and their families in particular. So there's other stuff that's introduced in on a national level, if you want to look at that. Once you get past the personalities of Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you got to look at what Mr. Trump has done. And he has wrecked the Department of Labor. Right now, he has put people in charge that have made what used to be OSHA, which you could rely on for job safety and protection. He's made that in spirit, if not in name, the Department of Management, with Scalia being appointed as the cabinet position. The ability of an employer to investigate and record workplace coronavirus cases, they suspended that. So no employer is going to have to determine whether the essential workers are being exposed to COVID-19 or getting sick as a result of their jobs. So there's lists of things that they've done on a national level that affect your civil rights and so forth. And this is about keeping the table level. This election is probably the most important one of my life for a variety of reasons. And when I say keep the level, nobody wants to go to court. But when they do go to court, they want to have a level playing field. They want to be able to stand up to the chambers of commerce and the insurance companies and the mega corporations that wish to profit off the backs and sweat of our members and their families. So it's very important that we vote our pocketbook, particularly so.
Voting our self-interest is very important. We're talking with labor attorney John Boyd, and he's got a lot of insight into the laws affecting labor for people in Missouri and Kansas. We have about a minute, 45 left. How important is protecting clean Missouri for the future of unions?
Well, we have, at my last count in the last election, probably 10 House seats that were really close enough in the voting to have been turned. The rest are gerrymandered, meaning that they have been so changed that if you want to be elected and you're a Republican, you may have to not ever have a Democrat run against you, but you have to run against somebody who may be further to the right. Conversely, if you're a Democrat, you may have to run further to the left. The idea is let's divide up all of those districts as evenly as possible so that the people have a say in who is going to be our representative rather than gerrymandered districts.
John, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are at that time where it's over now, and I appreciate you coming on. I personally really appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you and hearing you again.
Thank you, and may all of our listeners remain safe and secure.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Hello, KKFI listeners. We're excited to announce the new weekly public affairs program, Understanding Israel-Palestine, debuting in its new time slot of 9:30 a.m. every Friday, starting on September 18th. This show will present scholars, journalists, policy analysts, and activists explaining the realities that now prevail in that much-too-promised land. Once again, that's Understanding Israel-Palestine, starting Friday morning, September 18th at 9:30.
For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, your quality of life is impacted by the actions of elected officials. The deadline to register to vote, November 3rd, is October 7th in Missouri and 13th in Kansas. Register and vote November 3rd. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Dragons and mermaids and alligators? Oh my! It's Puppets A-Glo-Go, brought to you by Stone Lion Puppet Theater and KKFI, right in front of the National World War I Museum. September 25th and 26th, a drive-through art experience for the entire family. Giant illuminated puppets, aerialists, and glow performers, a free event for everyone. 7:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. nightly on September 25th and 26th. Tune your dial to KKFI for the soundtrack and stay in your car to see all the glowing art. Learn more at stonelionpuppets.org.
The musical prelude tonight was Eviction Blues by Root Boy Slim. I'm Michael Savoy, your host tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum. And our show tonight is entitled KC Tenants Rock. My guest is already a working class hero in Kansas City, Tara Raghavar, director of the KC Tenants Association. Good evening, Tara. How are you?
Hey, Michael, thanks so much for having me back here. It's good to be in conversation with you, and I'm doing okay, but, you know, times are tough.
Indeed they are, and they seem to be getting tougher. Tara, you first came to our radar screen early last year, and I think we had you on the show in July of last year, but for those who are not aware of your work, could you tell our listeners what you do at KC Tenants?
Sure thing. We started organizing with poor and working class tenants who have borne the brunt of housing insecurity and homelessness in Kansas City. We began meeting together last February 2019, so not so long ago, actually, but very quickly we built a base of those tenants and people experiencing homelessness across the city, and we got to work. We made housing the key issue in the municipal elections last spring. We worked all summer to write a tenants' bill of rights, and then we passed that through the city council in December of last year. It began being implemented in June of this year. Meanwhile, we've taken on campaigns against the biggest slumlords and corporate evictors in Kansas City, driving one of them completely out of business, out of the state of Missouri entirely. Along the way, we've been organizing tenants unions with brave tenants across the city who are sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they're taking matters into their own hands. And we've continued to grow and develop a base of really radical tenants taking agency over their own lives and agency to protect their neighbors. And then during the COVID pandemic, we have pivoted in the direction of defending tenants in their homes and protecting their rights to stay at home. And we've launched a tenant hotline. We have a mutual aid fund that's been up and running since March. And we've been campaigning at the local, the state, and the federal level to win tenants the protections that they deserve.
Indeed. Terry, you know, it's been said that this coronavirus has amplified all of the glaring inequities in our society. And to that, I would say you weren't looking, if that's your opinion. How has the virus impacted your work there at KC Tenants?
Pretty significantly. I mean, the thing that I keep reflecting on is that in the absence of a vaccine to treat the virus, in the absence of a prescription to treat the virus, housing was the vaccine. Housing was the prescription, right? We were all told starting in March, that in order to keep ourselves and our neighbors healthy, we should stay at home. We should shelter in place. So home has always been fundamental to people's livelihoods and their ability to live with dignity and in good health. But during this time, it's become even more the site of health, right? The site of security. And we knew immediately that that was going to become a huge problem, because even before the pandemic, there were over 10,000 people in Kansas City sleeping on the streets in a given night. Many more who experience other kinds of homelessness in shelters, in motels and extended stays, doubled up, living in their cars. And there are so many tenants for whom their homes themselves were not healthy to them, right? So telling a tenant to stay at home when there's black mold is not a particularly healthy suggestion. And then furthermore, you know, a couple weeks into the crisis, we started to realize there was another layer to this catastrophe when people were being laid off en masse. And again, it's important that we understand that housing was unaffordable to the majority of Americans before COVID hit, right? 12 million households across the country were paying over 50% of their income to rent before March. So add on top of that, unprecedented levels of unemployment, and we've got really an all-out catastrophe where people are still responsible every month for the rent payment, but they've been out of work for months. Maybe they're just getting back to work. Maybe they won't ever get back to work. And the debts have started to stack up, and people are really being buried under them in a literal sense, right? Folks are being evicted all over the place. We want an eviction moratorium back in the spring, but it, you know, the courts allowed it to expire in the end of May. So for 3 months, tenants have been evicted across Kansas City, forced to the streets, and of course, forced out of homes, and therefore their lives are at risk, right? Evictions are always a violent process, but especially now in the context of a pandemic, an eviction could be a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of weight of this moment that adds to the weight that we were already struggling through.
Indeed. Well, there's no question that Kansas City has an affordable housing crisis. With the expiration of city, county, and state moratoriums, although Missouri didn't have a state moratorium on eviction, could you tell our listeners about the new CDC, that is the Center for Disease Control, moratorium on evictions?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing, the first thing I want to say is that tenants won a national eviction moratorium. So on September 1st, when 43 million people were bracing themselves for eviction in the next 4 months, and when millions more Americans across the country were trying to figure out how to pay the rent because it was the first of the month, on September 1st, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, announced a federal eviction moratorium. And this comes after 6 months of tenant outcry and organizing and demands in the streets, at state houses, along highways, you name it. Tenants have been out there saying, eviction is a public health emergency. Eviction is something that's actually going to make this virus worse. And the CDC order on September 1st copped to that, right? It recognized that eviction was contributing to a public health disaster, and it said we must stop evictions if we are to contain the virus. So this moratorium was announced on September 1st, but it's not so simple. It ostensibly applies to every rental property in the country. It goes beyond what the CARES Act eviction moratorium protected, and it says that landlords cannot evict tenants for non-payment of rent. But there are some important caveats. One is that it requires the tenant to actually declare their need for this protection from their landlord. So I would argue that unduly puts the burden on the tenant to go, you know, tell their landlord that they can't pay the rent, find the form online, et cetera, before they benefit from this protection. The second major shortcoming is that it only protects against evictions on the basis of non-payment of rent. And what we know is that when a landlord wants a tenant out, they're going to find a way to get them out, whether through the legal process or not. So this moratorium still leaves room for landlords to file all sorts of other types of evictions that are not based on rent, but maybe based on a noise complaint or a lease violation or something like that. And we're worried about the impact that this might have on landlords simply avoiding the court process and forcing tenants out by their own means. And then finally, I think the biggest concern that we have with the CDC order is that it does nothing about the rent that's owed on the first of every month still, right? So tenants were clear since the beginning, since the earliest days of the pandemic, that an eviction moratorium was only half of the solution, that the real solution was going to be rent and mortgage cancellation, no payments, no late fees, no debt. That was the only way tenants were actually going to make it out of this thing alive. We can still, and we must, cancel rents and mortgages, because the moratorium alone, we're just kicking the can down the road. We're just waiting for another crisis moment in January.
In short then, Tara, this seems to be just another scheme by this administration to deceive the public. In other words, to make it appear that they're lending some support. What are your thoughts there?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, my first thought when I saw this order on September 1st was relief. This will bring relief and some temporary, you know, sanctuary for tens of millions of tenants across the country, potentially, right? My second thought was, this is overtly political, right? This is Donald Trump's offering to working class Americans. And it's his way of saying, you know, look what I did for you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to keep you in your home through the election, conveniently. And I'm going to provide you this relief. So you better thank me for it. It's overtly political. It is clearly a page out of Donald Trump's reelection playbook. Here's the thing, though, is that Democratic mayors and governors across the country have completely failed tenants through this period of time, right? Completely failed tenants. So in a weird way, Donald Trump is politically judicious because he's recognizing the pure desperation among tenants and working class people across the country. And he's playing into that, right? It might be, it totally is insufficient and a gross political game. The reality is, though, that Donald Trump has just outflanked most Democrats across the country who haven't found their way to doing anything substantial to help poor and working class tenants. You know, that's not meant to be a gross generalization. Of course, the House Democrats passed a relief bill that is still waiting for discussion in the Senate. And that relief bill includes a national eviction moratorium and more. But the reality is, this is a political game. And I think there's another way, or Trump is seeing this as a political game, I should say. And he is using the tools at his disposal to play that game, right? There's also another way to see this that's a little bit more optimistic, because I don't quite like the idea that tenants just become a pawn in Donald Trump's game. But I think there's another way to read this, which is that tenants, which is to say, you know, poor and working class people across the country, are a critical political class, right? And I think we would be wise as a movement to recognize that and to channel that power and actually treat it as power. Because what Trump's doing, gross as it may be, is an indication that working class people can and will decide the results of the election in November. And I think we need to be more thoughtful about that reality, and then how we bring our issues and how organizations like Casey Tenants bring our issues into elections and force politicians to contend with those, right? Because if we fail to do that, then we're just having a debate on their terms, which is usually not a debate that has anything to do with working class people. But if we recognize our power as a political class and force our issues into the conversation, then we're having a different political debate across the country.
Tara, there's been some really sound and thoughtful suggested remedies around this crisis, yet they've been summarily rejected by the business as usual politicians. What can you tell our listeners about H.R. 6515, introduced by Omar Ilhan Omar of Minnesota there, the so-called Rent and Mortgage Cancellation Act?
Well, it's a fabulous bill. I'm a bit biased because I was part of a crew of people across the country that helped to write it. But I think this bill that Ilhan Omar introduced on April 17th of this year is absolutely an example of what it looks like to listen to poor and working class people when they tell you what they need, right? When we started talking to tenants in our base in the earliest days of the pandemic about what they needed to be okay right now, they didn't say, I want a voucher. They didn't say, I want a subsidy. They didn't say, I want to apply for some assistance to pay my rent. They said, I don't want to have to worry about my rent right now, period. And I shouldn't have to, because I've been laid off and these are circumstances outside of my control, right? So they said, cancel my rent. And low-income homeowners were saying, cancel my mortgage payment. I can't pay my mortgage payment and I shouldn't have to, right? So we wrote a bill that says rent and mortgage cancellation is the only just way forward. But of course, it's more complicated than that. And we were more thoughtful than just, okay, we cancel payments, pure anarchy, right? I think the name of that bill scares people away from actually reading the substance. And that's on them. You know, it's a failure of the opposition to actually engage with this idea in good faith. Because I actually think it's one of the most rational ideas that's been proposed in the last 6 months. So it says cancel rents and mortgage payments. No payments, no late fees, no debts. It also says, let's create a relief fund for owners who face losses as a result of this cancellation, right? And let's actually not put a cap on that fund, but let's be explicit that if public money is going to be transferred to private pockets, it comes with conditions, right? So let's have the landlords apply for their own relief and be judged according to whether or not they actually need that relief, because some big corporate landlords don't, right? They can eat the losses, they'll be okay. But some smaller property owners might need that relief. So let's have them apply to get their own benefit as opposed to asking their tenant to apply for a benefit that's ultimately going to land with the landlord. And then secondly, let's not just give away public money, right? We've done that before, and it's a massive mistake, right? In the wake of 2008, we gave away God knows how many billions of dollars to private interests with no strings attached, and it didn't really work, right? It really did not translate to a bailout for the people. It was simply a bailout for the big banks and the 1%. So our perspective was, let's make a relief fund. Let's condition it on a set of things. What we don't want is for a landlord to get relief right now and then turn around and evict their tenant the next month. What we don't want is for the landlord to get a bunch of money from the federal government and then turn around and hike up rent so that they make even more profits, right? So let's put some reasonable conditions on the receipt of this public money and make sure that some owners, especially local owners and smaller owners, are stabilized through this period. And then the other thing that we built in there that's really important is that we know that a moment like this will mean that some smaller property owners just won't be able to make it, whether or not we cancel the rents, right? They just won't be able to sustain losses like this, just like in 2008. The problem in 2008 was that we didn't have any guardrails in place to stop the onslaught of corporate speculation that followed the financial crisis. So in places like Kansas City, tons of homes fell into foreclosure, and corporate speculators came swooping and gobbling them up, right? And that has completely changed our city for the worse in the last decade. So in the bill, we've also written in some provisions around allowing public purchase of those properties and community purchase of those properties so that they don't get gobbled up by corporate speculators.
Tara, we're nearing the last 30 seconds of our interview. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your Homes Guarantee organization, something new for you, and perhaps you can share that with our listeners in our closing minute.
Sure. So the Homes Guarantee is a national campaign that launched publicly in September of 2019. It's about a year old at this point, and the premise is very simple. We live in the richest country in the history of the world. We can and we must guarantee that everyone has a home, period. And the Homes Guarantee is a visionary agenda to make that a reality in America, hopefully within the next decade, we really need it now, but we're organizing and building power across the country to make that real.
Indeed. Kara, thanks so much for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum. I must say that my hat goes off to you, and you're high on my list of working class heroes right here. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, in whatever week this is of the global pandemic and unprecedented economic times, I thought I'd talk a little bit about some things that you may be seeing happening in your own jobs to talk about whether or not they're okay. The thing that I want to focus on today specifically is cutting hours, cutting benefits, and cutting pays for salaried employees. So most of the workers in the United States are what are called at-will employees, which means that they can be fired, they can have their hours reduced, their pay reduced for any reason at all or no reason, as long as it's not one of the discriminatory reasons. So like, for example, a job couldn't just cut the hours of the female employees. That would be a discriminatory reason. But across the board, broad cuts are going to be okay under U.S. law. There are a few rules related to it. The pay reductions can't be retroactive. So they can't say, well, we're cutting everything and you have to pay us back money that you've already earned. They can only apply to future checks. And there's no federal law that requires employers to give any kind of notice for the pay cuts or the hour cuts. However, some states do require this. I think New York, for example, requires at least 7 days notice in advance of a pay change. But if your state doesn't have this kind of protection, the employers can just mess around with compensation packages and even benefit packages without really much notice at all. Now, most employers are trying to give notices, but that isn't something that's required by law. There's a few caveats to that. For example, for non-exempt workers, which usually means that these are the hourly employees, a reduced paycheck can't make them go below either local or federal minimum wage laws. So whichever is higher, it can't go below that. Pay for non-exempt employees, these are people who tend to be salaried, can't drop below $684 a week, or whatever the state threshold is that's the same, without being moved to a non-exempt status. Now, a non-exempt status would then be people that would be eligible for overtime and are generally hourly workers. There's other things that employers can do during times of economic crisis to reduce their payroll, which labor costs tend to be the biggest expenditure in any business. There's other benefits that can be cut as well, like, for example, 401k matching, any other fringe benefits like that type of thing. Tuition, reimbursement, all of that stuff could be put on hold. Healthcare. Now, many people are super worried about this, particularly in the time of a pandemic. Changes to healthcare could, and your healthcare coverage through your job, could also happen, but is unlikely to probably happen until the next open enrollment period. So if your business is a business that, like, once a year you have to re-enroll in your healthcare plans and pick out the type of thing that you want to be involved in for that year, when you come up for this next time on re-enrolling and the open enrollment period, you may find that healthcare plans have higher deductibles or fewer benefits in another effort to try to control costs. Some people that have had their salaries cut or their hourly wage cut might be eligible for certain unemployment benefits. So that's something, if you have been affected by one of these types of changes, that you might want to check out in whichever state that you're living in to determine whether or not you might be eligible for some unemployment benefits that might make up some of that difference. Other than that, employers have a broad brush with which they can change the way their pay and their benefits are structured in order to try to keep the business afloat. I think we're just at the beginning of this turbulent time here, and we're going to be seeing a lot of creative efforts to try to reduce costs and try to get the economy back on track. But for today, that is all the time that I have. So wear your masks, stay safe, stay healthy, and I'll see you next month, Kansas City.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. This calendar is posted on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page, where you can also like our Facebook and get our notifications when we post new stories and upcoming shows and stuff like that. First off, on tomorrow, Friday, 9 a.m. to noon, there's a Wyandotte County Housing Summit, and that is online, and it's hosted by Livable Neighborhoods and Consensus. And you can find the link again on our Facebook page where this calendar is posted. The Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Meeting, no longer a breakfast, hopefully sometime soon, Saturday, September 19th, 9 a.m. There's a Zoom link also. Go to the Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast on Facebook, and you can find the link, or you can find it on our Facebook page. International Labor Solidarity Assembly, Monday, September 21st, from 2 to 3:30 p.m. This is a national event. It's online. It's hosted by Pioneer Valley Workers Center on Facebook. And rally to support striking sheet metal workers at Silgen Containers in St. Joe, which we talked about on the news. It's across from the plant manager's house, Sunday, September 26th, 1 p.m. at Rest Square Park, 2222 Voorhees, V-O-R-I-E-S Street in St. Joseph. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called Outrageous Nonprofit Union Busters, and we'll be talking about the Missouri budget cuts for kids. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. Where you come from to struggle.